My leg was felt like it was on fire. I picked it up and it flopped like it was made of jelly.
True Trauma Tales, treating life-changing injuries at the Leeds Major Trauma Centre.
I had someone trying to put pressure on my ankle. And I remember looking at her and she had this panic in her eyes because it wasn't stopping bleeding. That was the only word I really heard was amputation. I just freaked out. I remember saying that they're going to take my foot. They're going to take my foot.
Hello and welcome to True Trauma Tales. This is the podcast where we tell the stories of six people who were treated at Leeds Major Trauma Centre following life-changing accidents. And in this episode, we meet Henry, who was on his way to work on his motorbike when he was involved in a car crash. As well as hearing from him, we also speak to Mr. Paul Harwood, who was Henry's consultant trauma and orthopaedic surgeon.
I was living in Halifax and I just got a job in Leeds City Centre working in the IT industry. I'd worked in IT for about 15 years prior to that and I'd been working my way up, managed to get this job, and I'd been commuting for the first couple of days on my motorbike. And on the fourth day, beautiful day, clear as anything, nice and warm, in back end of June, and I was going through on the A58 through Wyke, and the speed limit had just changed from a 30 to a 40. And I was still doing just about 30 miles an hour. And out of nowhere, an SUV pulled out the side street. I had just enough time to spot what was happening and say no, 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 no about five times. And that was that. In the moment, I couldn't go behind the car because of the curb. If I slammed the brake on, it would have gone straight into the side of the car, which would have been, I think, a lot worse. So I had to try and get round in front of it and hope that they'd spot me in time enough to slam on and miss me. They didn't see me at all. They actually sped up to pull out of the junction and hit me side on, and my left foot was crushed between my engine and their engine. I took the whole front of their car off and I rolled down the road. But your brain does funny things in that situation. And I remember it all, but the moment of impact, my brain went to a slideshow. I remember just a slide picture of bits of bonnet and bumper and things flying in my face. And the next, I've stopped rolling and I've broken bones before, but this felt a lot different. My leg felt like it was on fire. I picked it up and it flopped like it was made of jelly. So I was, I'll just put that back down there. Laid that back down on the floor. And then there was this pool of blood that was getting bigger and bigger. By this point, people have come over that were in the cars coming the other way. And then it just got all chaotic. And you could see the fear on the people's faces. I had someone trying to put pressure on my ankle. And I remember looking at her and she had this panic in her eyes because it wasn't stopping bleeding. It didn't take long for the police and the paramedics to come and control the scene and whatnot. And once the paramedics were there, everything got a lot calmer, strapped me all up, cut everything off me as they do, and got me in the back of the ambulance. But the paramedics were out of this world. They were next level. If I remember rightly, he was ex-military, the main paramedic that was treating me. And he was very good at calming the situation, calming me down and talking me through what was going on and whatnot. So I'm very thankful for him being there. And then I vaguely remember getting to the hospital and thanking them as they left me in a room full of people. But then that's when it goes all blurry, because they've put me under anaesthetic and put me to sleep to poke around what was left of my foot, really.
Were you in pain at that point in time, or were you aware of the severity?
I knew something was very wrong. Like I said, I've broken bones before. You can't feel a break, really. It's more the shock that sets in. This was hot, fiery pain. So I knew that it was a lot worse than anything I'd ever done before. So yeah, I was very aware that something was bad, but I didn't quite know to what extent.
And how long
did it take for you to then come around and them to explain and you to be able to digest the situation?
So after getting to the hospital and then being put to sleep, they woke me up to tell me what was going on, basically. And I remember coming to Mr. Harwood was standing over me with another doctor. He referred to him as his boss at the time. And all I really took was amputation. That was the only word I really heard. I just freaked out. You would. And I remember saying that they're going to take my foot. They're going to take my foot. And so because I was panicking, they said, what we'll do is we'll make it structurally sound. We'll get it right to give you a little bit of time to process what's going on and what your options are. But he said, I am going to have to go in and poke around. So we're going to put you back to sleep. I remember then I came to like on the ward in the bed, and I'd been in for surgery, and what they'd done is to reinforce my leg. They put like scaffolding frame down one side with pins to hold it all in place. And that was basically so that I had enough time to talk to Mr. Harwood, talk to the nurses, figure out a plan of what we wanted to do, whether I wanted to keep it and try and save it or have it amputated.
Because it must be such an astonishing thing to take in, to think that 3-4 hours previously you were just on your way to work and you had your day planned out ahead of you with things that you were going to be doing and getting up to, and all of a sudden you're being asked these huge life-changing questions, and it must have been extremely difficult to digest and just understand.
It's very messy. It emotionally, physically, mentally, it's you're all over the place. Even the anesthetic from being in surgery, it confuses you for days. It stays in your system for about 2 weeks. So afterwards, your brains are just all over the place, and you get all emotional for no reason and stuff like that. It's all that adds to the effect of finding all these horrible things out, really.
So it's really hard, and I'm never sure from a patient perspective how early to introduce that concept. So in Henry's case, this was a decision that we came to together. There are some people who, they don't have an option. Some of the really severe injuries are not reconstructable. But one thing that we've learned over the years, and it's not just our experience, it's other places of collective experience, is that for some people, whilst you can save a limb, what you save isn't worth having, if that doesn't sound too harsh, and is actually more troublesome, and people have less function and more pain and are able to do less, and it's much more complicated and their treatment is much longer, then actually a really good outcome from an amputation will almost always be better. And so I always think it's good to try and introduce that early. I do wonder if sometimes we get a bit over enthusiastic and whether it's better to let the dust settle slightly before. Henry's got a whimsical smile. Yeah, don't hit me with that sledgehammer at the doorway. But we try to introduce it early and talk about it as a treatment option rather than thinking of it as failure of other things, if that makes sense. So traditionally, it often gets thought of as a last resort, and it's only what you would choose if everything else has failed. Whereas for a lot of people, it's a good option instead of going down those very complicated treatment pathways, which at the end of the day often have high complication rates and high failure rates.
Henry, how did you come to make your decision?
So initially, I didn't like the idea of it at all. I really freaked out with the whole idea. But going back to what you were saying, it was good, I think, to have that put into your head early, so that is actually something that would be an option. But I didn't have that many options, really. It was a mess. It wouldn't have been a good idea to salvage it. Going through with you about what you'd have to do to salvage it, especially, sounded horrific.
Yeah.
And then I actually got visited by somebody from day one at peer support.
Yeah.
volunteer. His name was Bob. He was an amputee. He'd tried to salvage his leg because he was in a crash. He tried to salvage his leg for 7 years and had infection after infection. And
yeah.
Had it amputated and was a lot happier, functioning a lot better, be able to do more stuff and get out and about on his prosthetic. And so that kind of helped me to actually say yes to do it. It was actually verbally saying it, which was my major hurdle that I had to get over. I just couldn't do it. And that just allowed me to go, okay, let's do it.
I think is a great thing, which I know you now contribute to. I think, and you know, the ability to talk to someone, because I can say what I like, but I have never lived through that. And the authenticity of someone who's been through all of this speaking to a patient, I think, is really powerful. And then we try to get people from the rehab, the amputation rehabilitation service, to come. And I think we managed to get one of the physios to talk to you from that service. We have a really fantastic group of clinical psychologists who can come. And it's not so much about counselling, I think, to make you feel better about it. It's about trying to help you make a decision and understand how you're processing things and help you with that. And we know that patients who engage with that, and we allow them to engage with that by giving them time, do cope much better with the event. And then they do in rehab faster and improve better. And I do remember, Henry, you had a real wobble the day afterwards, wasn't it? Is it suddenly all crashed onto you? And then you picked up and went from there, I think, was my sort of recollection after the actual amputation.
Yeah, so it was a shock to the system. I remember coming to after the amputation surgery and I couldn't look at it.
Yeah.
I couldn't look at it. All I could do was cry. Anesthetic doesn't help with what it does to you. And then once got myself together a little bit, they were taking me back up to the ward and a porter picked up my oxygen tank and he put it on the bed where my leg would have been.
Yeah.
Lost it. My brain couldn't comprehend like what that, the feeling of nothing being there where you put the bottle. Obviously it's nothing to, this is there every day, so they're not really thinking like that. But it was such a shock to the system. But yeah, it took me a long time to get my head around it. I didn't sleep at all. All night was just crying and trying to get my head around it. And I just couldn't look at it. And the next day I was exhausted because I hadn't slept. So they put me in my own private room just to get some quiet because you've got alarms going off on the
show. Oh, it's a terrible environment, isn't it? It's designed to stop you sleeping, isn't it?
Yeah. And I tried meditating to try and calm my heart and my mind down a little bit. But every time I relaxed and my heart rate got lower, my alarms went off.
So that
would freak me out again. And then
set you off again.
And then it'd go too high and then the alarms would go. It was just a constant battle of alarms. It was a nightmare.
And at a point as well where I imagine you must have been extremely aware of your own mortality.
Yeah.
It completely changes the way you think about everything and take everything for granted.
So how did you come to terms? Was it time? Was it a combination of different people, seeing Louise, the therapist?
I just talked to anyone who'd listen, really. I just witter at everybody. And it wasn't to get people's opinions. It was just to get what I was thinking out.
Help me
process it, really. So just talking to people. And then, I don't know, I just went, it's gone now. There's nothing I can do about it. So it was like, once I got a wheelchair, and I'd actually got out of the bed for the first time in weeks, I was like, oh, okay, let's reassess.
There is a world out there still, isn't there? Yeah.
Let's reassess. And I remember it was one of the hottest summers we'd ever had, I think.
Yeah, it was crazy, wasn't it?
I'd missed all the really hot weather from just sitting behind this glass on this ward. And just to get the wheelchair and be able to go outside and get some fresh air. That alone was a massive help.
And I think it's easy to look at things and say, brilliant, you've had the operation now and that must be the hard bit over. But a lot of people that we've spoken to have said, well, that's almost, looking back, been the easy part.
Definitely.
The work starts then, doesn't it, I think?
That was all out of my hands, really.
Yeah.
But then comes the legal side of things.
Yeah.
And learning how you're going to have to change your life and do everything differently. For the first few months, just getting up and making a cup of tea is a bit of a mission. You've got crutches and wheelchairs to deal with, and all your processes that you do regularly are just completely different. So you've got to reset everything and figure out new ways of living normally. And that's a massive thing, putting the legal side on top of that as well. And it's a nightmare.
Yeah, at a time when your brain is really not ready for documents and hearings and all the rest of it. How long did you stay in hospital for before you were able to actually make it home? And what sort of adaptations, if any, did you need when you went home?
So I was in the hospital for 15 days and my house was not appropriate to be on crutches or in a wheelchair. You couldn't turn the wheelchair around in the hallway. Just had to go back and forwards. I had to get out of the wheelchair to get on the sofa because you couldn't fit it between the chairs to get in the front room. They wanted me to sleep downstairs. It wasn't appropriate. And I wanted to go upstairs to bed. I didn't want to change that routine. And so I didn't change anything. I just thought, I'll leave everything exactly how it is and then learn to cope with it and find different ways of doing things. And I think that was a lot easier than actually making the adaptations.
Do you think that helped your mind frame as well, your mindset?
In the long run, possibly. I've worked in IT. I've always been a bit of a problem solver. And every day would chuck a new problem at you. So I think it did help. I'm a bit stubborn as well. So that's...
I think that really helps, to be honest.
And were there things that you had on like a list of, this is, I cannot wait until I can achieve this, or I want to try and see if I can do whatever, whether that was something new or whether that was something that you had done previously?
I really wanted to get back to driving because I was just cooped up. I'd only moved to Halifax for work and I was just stuck in this box of a room. I couldn't go anywhere. So I had to wean myself off all the opiates and things so that I could get back to driving as quickly as possible. But then you've got the whole legal side of it that's going on that stops you from getting behind the wheel and things like that. But getting back to driving was a big goal, and that luckily that happened quite quickly.
And what did that feel like?
It's freedom. It's new freedom again. It was fantastic just to get out of my house that didn't involve being taken by someone. And you get a little bit of independence back, even if it's just simply driving and then coming home again. You're not actually going anywhere. But yeah, no, it was...
It's that feeling that you can, I think, isn't it? The loss of independence, I think, is something our patients really feel, whatever treatment they select. And you take it for granted, don't you, I think, that you're like, I can leave here now and go where I want. I want to go here, I want to go there. I might not do, but I can. And that feel, I think you feel quite trapped, don't you? I get that a lot from patients, that it's a massive step once they can do that, because they become so dependent on other people for things. Quite frightening, I think.
I still have that a little bit. I still take it for granted because I might get skin irritation or a blister.
Yeah.
Can't put my prosthetic on. And I'm back into being on crutches and wheelchair. And then everything's gone back to being really awkward and annoying. And then that's probably two weeks of where I'll just go, oh, I can't do anything for 2 weeks.
That must be really hard, that constant back and forth and back and forth.
It's something I try and I don't really think about because I don't like thinking about it. And then all of a sudden it'll happen and I'll just, because I've not thought about it, I get really irritated, but it's always going to be there. I'm always going to have weeks where I can't put my leg on due to something.
And when it comes to prosthetics. What are the conversations that are had and what are the options that you were given?
You pretty much, you get one for every day sort of use. Privately, I've got, through the case, my leg that I wear most of the time, to be honest, but it's my gym leg. I train on it. That's quite rigid. It has a bit of a shock absorber in the middle that allows me to box. It allows me to weight train comfortably and things like that. But then I've got a walking leg that has, it's got an electronic ankle. So it detects when your knee goes over your toe and it propels you forward like a foot would. So I've got that for walking around on, which it does help, but it has its downsides. It's incredibly heavy. Battery goes, you're just dragging it around. They're very expensive.
Yeah.
A new set of a pair of batteries is $2,500. So it's, and obviously they're only under warranty for a few years. So it's not a financially viable option for the majority of people. I probably won't end up with another one. But it depends what works for you. The NHS one that we're working on, they're working on one that's a different system. So it's a pin lock system so that it allows me to bend my knee more, like 90 degrees, because I'm on a suction system that involves rubber sleeves around my knee. So I can't bend my knee very much, which causes issues if I have to sit in tight chairs, or if the back of the chair is too close to you, if I have to get on a plane or public transport, it's really awkward. I can't cycle because I can't bend my knee enough. So that's what they're working on with me. And it seems to be working quite well. Through my private prosthetic center, I actually went on a day where we went skiing, Chill Factory in Manchester. They take your prosthetic foot off your socket and they put on a specially designed snow foot that clips directly into your ski. So you've got one boot and one that just clips straight into the ski. And that's actually got a shock absorber in the ankles. It was the first time I've actually had the sensation of bending my foot since I lost it. But that was great. So you've got, the options are pretty much endless. It's just who's going to pay for it at the end of the day.
And so what does your future look like for you?
That's a good question. I don't know, to be honest. I'm still trying to figure it out. Because the case is not long finished, I'm trying to catch up, basically, trying to figure out what I want to do. My career in IT, that's pretty much gone unless I completely retrain because of the way IT progresses and new technologies are working. And I don't think I want to work behind a desk again.
Mm.
Your priorities have changed after something like this so much. Meaningless office work just doesn't really cut it for me anymore. I don't know. I'm doing volunteering with Day One Trauma Support. We'll see where that goes. That might end up with something more for me. I don't know. I'm just trying to figure it out, really.
That's about all we have time for, but thank you so much for joining us. If you want to find out more information about anything you've heard today, you can find more details in our show notes.